You're listening to Unpaused, a podcast for women who want to stage a career comeback or mastermind a new one after an extended break from work. I'm your host, Judy Stewart, and if you want to reclaim your career but don't know how, then this is the podcast for you. Let's meet our guest for today. Carol Westmore is a very capable woman. A mathematician by training, she exudes order and authority. However, Carol has found herself immersed in an adventure very much of her own making, the restoration of the artist John Glover's house and farm near Deddington, 40 or so kilometres from Launceston in Tasmania. In embracing that undertaking, enormous, costly, and full of the usual joys and setbacks, she unwittingly began to engineer her reinvention as Chatelaine of Glover Cottage and keeper of the Glover Flame, a reinvention which is still unfolding in the most intriguing ways. Still more intriguing is how Carol's story directly mirrors the reinvention that Glover himself experienced when, at the age of 63, he turned his back on celebrity as an artist in just post-Regency London and set sail for colonial Hobart, whereupon he began sketching what he saw almost at once. Little did Glover know then that in the canvases that were to follow, he was inaugurating Australia's distinctive landscape painting tradition. Think Sidney Nolan, Fred Williams, John Olson, Bill Robinson. In their way, each continued what Glover began by painting the Australian landscape just as he saw it. Both stories of reinvention, and with the greatest respect, Carol, I'll call them later in life reinventions, although separated by centuries, have long tales and many unexpected parallels. I'll let Carol tell the story. Carol, welcome to Unpaused.
Good morning, Judy.
You studied maths in Melbourne. You married Rodney Westmore, the ophthalmologist. You ended up in Launceston, where you and Rodney established the first eye hospital in Tasmania, and which you not only helped to build, you then managed it for many years into a very valuable operation. Tell me what led you to Deddington and John Glover.
Well, Rodney and I had begun farming on King Island about 30 years prior to Deddington. Because of the difficulties of actually getting to King Island, we moved from there to another farm at the mouth of the Tamar in northern Tasmania. And then this opportunity to acquire another farm, having disposed of the first two, came up. This was all very much a part-time activity. We were absentee farmers, and the Glover property was on the market. It was close to Launceston. It had an interesting history, obviously, and so it just seemed like a good idea at the time.
So already you had changed course, in a sense, to become the manager of this very big sort of undertaking that the hospital was. And then slowly you were also morphing into a farmer and then taking this direction with Glover.
Well, he left England and arrived in Tasmania, in northern Tasmania, on his 64th birthday. And he was leaving a very successful, established career. He was wealthy. His paintings were expensive. He probably came out to Tasmania to join family members because three of his sons had acquired smaller land grants in the south. There were reports going back to London from scientists in Tasmania of the interesting and different flora and fauna, and the climate would have been appealing to him. But I suspect it was partly to join his younger sons.
It must have been a massively shocking thing to have done. I mean, people must have been scandalised that he just could turn his back on
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Have you heard that Glover's left for Tasmania? Mm. And his wife, when you think about it, his wife was 70 at the time when they arrived. And it was clearly going to be a one-way journey. There was no way they sold up everything, sold lots of paintings, sold their house. So it was just boots and all in, let's try this and see what happens. He loved the land. He grew up on a farm, and his sketchbooks that he painted from, of which he was said to have brought 104 with him, they contained many rural scenes, sketches of cows, some sheep and rural properties. And I think also London was undergoing a very smoggy period at the time, and it was depressed. It would have been very enticing, especially with the offer of land that the government was giving away that they didn't actually own. That system of land grants was drawing to a close. So the opportunity to take up a free land grant was a part of the inducement as well. He was able to get the maximum land grant because of his assets. You had to demonstrate that you could farm the land and put buildings, infrastructure on it and develop it. They had assigned convicts. They had money to buy stock. Probably the assigned convicts built the house. So there was an early cottage, four-roomed cottage that they built, and again with the help of his sons. And then they erected a larger cottage very quickly, I might add, because he was in a hurry to move from Hobart up to the north to move into the house. His studio that he built, he was in a hurry to get that erected. He was said to have painted in a tent prior to the studio being completed. But all of the house and the studio and other buildings were built in a hurry, and they had structural issues from early on, which is evident from the supportive buttresses and steel rods that tied the front and back walls together, attached to beams on the front and back of the house. So all of these structural defects were apparent from early on. And they also built it in a very difficult location. The land was very picturesque, but he chose a site where he had water for the garden and the house. But that spring that flowed down the side of the house also flowed into the very heavy clay soil, and the sandstone, of course, absorbs water in winter and dries out in summer. So that contributed to the structural defects that were apparent very early.
But, Carol, for all of that, it's a very attractive house. He didn't just build any house.
Yes, it is lovely, and it's in a lovely setting. But it's a simple house. It's not grand or pretentious. He was a simple person. He was Presbyterian, and I think it was fairly plain. There weren't any real embellishments in the house, as some later settlers added. I mean, compare it to Clarendon, just down the road at Nile, which is a very grand house, and that was built probably 10 years later by a landowner who'd show off and say, This is me and this is my estate.
He got it all done in less than a year, didn't he? I think to our life, which is so built on convenience, imagine having to start from scratch, design and build your own house, grow the trees to grow
the
fruit,
veggies.
You plant the vegetables and have some flowers as well, buy the livestock, get the livestock going, producing milk, then you're making cheese. It was lucky that Mrs. Glover was so domesticated.
Yes, indeed. I think she was probably a housekeeper he married. So she was used to hard work and she didn't mind it. In fact, she had female convicts assigned to her to work in the house, and they had rooms assigned in the attics, probably locked in at night. But she dismissed some of those girls. She said they were hussies and she'd prefer to do the work herself.
At 70?
Yes, at 70. And she got down, she was said to get down on her hands and knees and scrub the sandstone floors.
Incredible.
Hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine. So, Carol, you bought the house and it was a complete ruin. What was your aim in buying that? Had you thought about, you know, what your goal was and how long it would take and how you'd do it?
Well, no, the aim in buying it wasn't really to restore John Glover's house. I was aware of the house, but it was to buy it as a significant rural property close to Launceston. The house was not quite a ruin. The front wall had fallen down in the 1940s. So the farmers at the time who owned it after Glover, they put it back together as quickly as they could with a concrete front wall and weatherboard on the upper story, modern windows. They covered over with cheap boards, covered over all the falling hard plaster and stonework and lath and plaster inside the house. They just needed to get it back into shape for a farm worker to live in. And in fact, when we bought the property, there was a farm worker living in the house. So it was habitable, but not very attractive, not warm, not comfortable. So in a way, it was less attractive in that condition than if it had just been left as derelict. I mean, there's a certain romance to a property that's a house that's falling down around your ears. But this one had modern materials added to it and was most unattractive. The original garden had long gone. The studio there was no evidence of that remaining. So it really wasn't a very attractive proposition. And it was some time before I really worked out what I could do with the house and how I could do it. Initially, it was just such a formidable task that I put it off for several years while I thought about it. And then I was pushed and prodded into dealing with the house. After the farm worker had vacated, I had to work out and think about what to do with the house. And that really coincided with a growth of interest in John Glover as an artist. There was a local landscape prize that started in 2003 that is still held now, the John Glover Landscape Prize. This is a very significant acquisitive prize that's held in Evandale every year. Also, there was a big exhibition at Tas Museum and Art Gallery in 2003, and Professor David Hanson had produced a very good catalogue from that exhibition, and that became my Bible for many years until the most recent publication by Ron Radford.
And so, Carol, you were always guided then by the scholars who were already expert in the paintings of John Glover. Just talk about his art, because it's so important to the district, isn't it, that he painted these canvases at Patterdale Farm. You have been able to sort of quarantine his art in a way in the setting in which he painted it, and that there is a direct correlation between what he saw and what you can still see today.
In fact, that is the real treasure that we have at Patterdale, Judy. The views and landscapes that Glover painted of Patterdale, we can still go to those places where you can see exactly what Glover was looking at and painting. Some of them are a little bit different now because there are mature trees that have grown up since Glover's time that obscure some of the views, but others are pretty much exactly what he was looking at. So, for instance, the painting My Harvest Home, he was painting the convicts bringing in the harvest in the height of summer on two wagons that would have then been carted back to his barn and stables. And because that grain was growing on rich river flats, you just see grass in the foreground and the skyline behind the hay carts and the grain. It's still river flats. It's still very rich ground. We still grow wheat and grass and other crops there. So there's nothing being built and there are no mature trees in that painting. So you can go and see exactly. Mm. And because the landscape is still unchanged, you can go to the exact spot where I've marked with a seat and a stand with the painting and some interpretation on it. So there are seven major painting walks that you can go on that take you to these images. There are another two, actually, that I need to add to those painting walks, paintings that have been re-identified, if you like, following the research Ron Radford did in writing his book about John Glover and Patterdale Farm. So they're paintings. They're just 5 minutes walk from the house. And that's where the places Glover would have gone to sketch those landscapes. And then he would come back to his studio to paint them.
So let's just talk about Ron Radford and who he is.
Ron Radford is a former director of the most recent former director of the National Gallery of Australia. And prior to that, he was the director of the Art Gallery in South Australia, where there are 13 major Patterdale paintings. We're very fortunate that he has retired to Hobart. And he first visited the house 30, 40 years ago and has been a custodian of Glover paintings over a long period of time. He's absolutely passionate about Glover. And so he came many years ago, but he's come again more recently when he heard, I suppose, that I was restoring the house. So he's walked on this journey with me and been to visit a number of times.
And so did you contact him or did he contact you?
No. I did not contact him. I can't remember what the initial contact was. Possibly he was brought by a friend. And over this period of time that we've been talking about, Judy, that I've owned Patterdale, there was an increasing interest in John Glover and Patterdale. Many people wanted to come and see where Glover painted. So I had people driving up to my house. I live 2 kilometres away. My house is an earlier house than Glover's and it's quite distinctive. So people would drive up and say, oh, is this where John Glover lived? And I said, oh, no, it's just down the road, but there's nothing much to see. And there wasn't. And then I started having tour groups wanting to come. Australian Garden History Society and Australiana. I had a tour group from the Yale Centre for British Art came from Boston. They brought out a group of PhD students in art history and architecture. And they came to do a tour of the Glover paintings in the State and National Galleries. And that was before I started the restoration. Mm. So this was part of the impetus that led me to think, well, I really needed to restore the house before it did fall down.
And when that conviction took hold, did you have sleepless nights lying there thinking about
it? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And a long period of indecision when the builder who later undertook the work first came to walk through the house with me. We spent some time and we walked away afterwards and quietly he said to me, why would you?
Mm.
Because the task was really to pull down all of the old repairs and replace the front wall, strip off all the lining boards inside the house to expose all the damage, and then still I would just have the house, same size, same shape. As I'd said, it was habitable when we first purchased the property, but of course once we started the restoration it was no longer habitable. I guess one of the main reasons why I started when I did was that there was another major crack opening up on one of the side walls, And I was really frightened that that wall might have fallen down as well and gone the way of the front wall. And if that had happened, well, it would have just been a pile of rubble and irretrievable.
What was it, do you think, about Glover that really touches you? What is it about him that you love?
Well, I think the fact that he came out, he made this extraordinary journey at an advanced age, and he then went on to have a renaissance of his career, not in terms of selling paint. I think he sold vast numbers once he was in Tasmania, but his style evolved. I think the Tasmanian light, which was so very different from what he had lived with and experienced in England and London, it was just this joyous outpouring of creativity that he had. And interesting, if you don't mind me adding, Judy, while you were doing your introduction, I just realised the parallel with my life, that I started this journey of restoration, preparing the history and the conservation management plan at about Glover's age.
Yeah. It is fascinating, isn't it, that you were both in that sort of later stage. And, you know, Carol, what interests me is that you're obviously a very analytical person. You're a mathematician. I think you studied cryptology. And so you're definitely a very analytical person. But this...
Logical and rational.
Logical and rational.
Well, some of the time.
Yeah. But this is a labour of love. And also sort of puts you really into the foreground with art history and important Australian history. How do you see yourself now?
Well, I think my interest in art, both colonial art and contemporary art, grew before even we purchased Patterdale. So I was just very interested. I have no skills as a painter, or any other creative skills, really. But I was very interested in the contemporary art scene, not just in Tasmania, but in Australia. So I think, and with some early colonial paintings that I had, the fact that my history of restoring houses and doing farming and being interested in art, it all combined together in this last project, which is definitely my last, Julia.
Well, it seems to be an everlasting project, not a last project.
It is ongoing.
Patterdale Farm is famous for its fine merino wool. Can you just talk about that for a moment and also how that relates back to Glover as a wool grower?
The property itself is suited to superfine wool growing. And when we purchased the property, we also purchased a very good flock of superfine merinos.
And are they the aristocrats of merino sheep?
Yes, they are.
They are. Yep.
And they produce fine wool there because of the natural environment. It's fertile land in a valley, but surrounded by a very large area of native bush, trees, rocky hillsides. And the merino sheep thrive in that, whereas some other more English breeds would not thrive. And it's also partly that land that's suited to growing the superfine merino, it's not really suited to cropping. The river flats and the lower land is, but the higher ground isn't, which has really kept it intact and kept those landscapes intact for all of this time, for virtually 200 years, because nobody has it. You couldn't develop it economically.
So where does Patterdale sit in the hierarchy of producers, and what do you do with your wool?
Well, I wouldn't class myself as a particularly good superfine wool grower. I have a farm manager who is responsible for that. We sell our wool mostly to Italian woolen mill, where it's processed into wool for suits or fine knitwear.
I imagine they pay a premium for this fine merino Australian wool.
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's the most expensive wool you can buy. And also we grow the sheep and the wool, to use that horrible buzzword, sustainably. And we have the farm adheres to the responsible wool standard, which is probably the highest accreditation you can achieve that American and European brands are looking for when they're trying to sell their products.
Well, Carol, I know you're not going to take the credit for it and you're going to give it to the farm manager, but I'm going to give it to you. Because, you know, you've had to learn about all of this, which, again, was a whole new chapter where you had to get on top of all the detail, what the Italian producers would want, how you grow it, how to compete, you know, all these things. It doesn't all just happen by magic.
No, that's true. And I have learned on the job over the years. I mean, we've been farming for 40 years and the farming community is very warm and welcoming and they're very happy to share their knowledge. And I'm, as a female, am not averse to asking for advice.
And what about Mr. Glover? He also farmed sheep and sent the fleeces back to England.
He did. Yes, but he would have been perhaps similar to myself in one sense, in that he had convicts working for him. He had sons who had been working on the land in England and they came out here and had their own farms before two of them came up and joined Glover. So he would have delegated the farming to them. He was just so keen to get on with his painting that I don't think he spent much time overseeing the farm at all.
Mm. I know that Rodney died in 2020. And how far along this journey were you when he passed away?
The house restoration had been finished. The garden had been planted. That was first planted in 2019. It was very much complete. He was not very involved in later years in what was actually happening. He was just very happy for me to go ahead and do it.
Yes, so you had the freedom to go and do that. Mm. So what would you say now, having got the house restored, you've done the garden beautifully, you've opened the house regularly to visitors, so everything's sort of up and running as an historical site that's able to be visited. You've got artists in residence programs. You're working with different agencies now to keep the whole thing going. Dr. Radford has brought out his book on Glover, Patterdale, Carol Westmore and the whole story, which is a fantastic read. And I've now read it, I think, three times, and it's absolutely beautifully done. But what would you say, Carol, are your... Oh, and I just want to mention, is it possible that you published that book?
Oh, it is possible, Judy. Yes.
So you did. That is your imprint under which the book was published.
Yes, it is.
Yes, Carol. So let me ask you, Carol, what are your aims now?
Well, I need to try and manage all of the increasing activity at the Glover House and put in place a process so that it will continue on without me, because I'm not going to be around forever. And that is a real challenge, to try and figure out how to do that.
Is it heritage listed?
It is heritage listed in Tasmania. Probably the next process is to get national heritage listing, but that is said fairly quickly, but that is a huge process to go through. So that's probably my next target, the thing I need to aim for. I have more building works I have to do. And at the moment, there are several toilets and bathrooms that have been installed in the house, but I need to have some external facilities for visitors. I've had one request from a school group to come and do some drawing and look at what Glover painted and so on. 100 students wanted to bring. I can't cater for that many people at once. So some extra facilities that you can access from a discreet location at the bottom of the garden. I need to rebuild the shearers' quarters for the farm, and I have plans drawn up, an architect has drawn up plans to make those quarters more fit for function and also suitable for artists in residence as well, so I can expand that program. Because, I mean, the artists who apply for the residency at the moment just love it because they get to stay in this beautiful house that's very nicely furnished and very precious furniture, I might add, surrounded by Tasmanian landscape paintings. I mean, who wouldn't want to come?
I know, it's really special. So it doesn't sound like you've got an exit plan just yet. But what would you say about reinventions later in life? What are your thoughts on that, how it's changed your life? Because there's so much emphasis now on ageism and, you know, everything's over by the time you sort of hit 60. And then here you are, you've completely started again. You've got a whole new career and alongside a serious responsibility for the combined properties and as working farming concerns. What are your thoughts about this late life reinvention?
Well, it's not really been a reinvention, more an evolution. I think in life we often just move in directions as fortune or circumstances dictate. We don't necessarily choose to go in particular directions. And I think that's really been the story of my life. I went to school in Melbourne, and if somebody had said to me then, oh, well, 40 years later, you'll be running a farm in Tasmania and learning about John Glover and possibly restoring his house, it would have just been laughable. The thought that I might find myself in those circumstances. But you know, I'm married, my husband and I moved to London for a year, came back here. He came back here because there was an opportunity to do that, and he started private practice. I'd never been to Tasmania in my life before we came back here to live. I must say I was pretty shocked when I did first arrive, having through the suburbs of Launceston. But I wouldn't move now from here, and my life is now so rich and has just gone in this wonderful direction. I mean, this project has been a wonderful thing for me because I have so many interesting people in my life now. I have groups who come to visit as well as regular open days, and every single one of them has really interesting people. It's magic.
Well, I take my hat off to you, Carol. It's a wonderful story and it's not over yet. So thank you for coming on Pause.
Thank you, Judy. It's been lovely talking to you.
Carol said something right at the end of the interview that I want to come back to. I think in life we often just move in directions as fortune or circumstances dictate. We don't necessarily choose to go in a particular direction. And perhaps this is so for women who are swept up in a family enterprise or who have foregone career steps because of family or other commitments, and they go with it. What's interesting is how both Carol and Glover were swept up by circumstances, both coincidentally at 63, in a way neither could nor would have predicted even 10 years before. In Glover's case, the momentous decision to leave London and start again in Tasmania unleashed the most creative chapter of his working life. And in Carol's, it's no small thing to be Tasmania's most successful fine wool producer and custodian of Patterdale House and Farm. Both had worked hard, of course, for all their professional lives, but for it all to culminate in such professionally rewarding ways is the triumph. The parallels between John Glover and Carol Westmore are uncanny, especially given the centuries that divided their experiences. But it's interesting that it was Patterdale and a way of life, rather than the primary lure of riches, that drew them in and created their own rewards for each. Carol's scientific background and management skills, honed in the hospital in Launceston, combined with an eye for Australian art and the constitutional energy to get the job done found in Carol a person whom it turns out was ideally suited for the job of resuscitating the Glover property and nurturing his legend. She still has National Heritage status for the property in her sights, and I'll be surprised if she and Dr. Radford don't find their mark. What do they say about getting things done? Give a busy woman a job. Thanks to Leonie Marsh for producing this and all episodes of Unpaused, and Jason Milhouse for his work in the recording studio. Until next time, farewell from me.